episode 314.
My message to industry is they need to step up, as you did with the school in your area, because they're going to need that support from the local business communities. That's one thing Board of Trustees will listen to. If they're there and they're strong and they're backing the program will be in much better shape than if they're leaving alone, because they will die on the vine. The next financial downturn, CTE is going to be in a crisis.
Welcome, aftermarketers, to Remarkable Results Radio. Listen to learn just one thing from today's episode on your journey to remarkable results. Welcome, aftermarket professionals, to the premier aftermarket talk radio podcast. Carm Capriotto here. You do know how much I love to travel to special events and set up the recording studio, don't you? Well, Vision has been a perfect event for capturing great aftermarket talk radio. Here's another that I know you will gain just one insight that will change how you involve yourself with the automotive education process. You're here in episode 314 on Remarkable Results Radio. Hey, I'm here to tell you that the Aftermarket's premier podcast is supported by Federal Mogul Motor Parts. They are the reason you enjoy these great aftermarket interviews. You know the brands. You've embraced them for years. Moog, Felpro, Wagner Brake, Anco, Champion, Seal Power, FP Diesel, and more. They're the parts Tech Trust. Get more information on these brands and the great programs for you at fmmotorparts.com. Hey, I'd love to welcome new Facebook friends Scott Bickley, John Rogers, Rick Mills, Frank Capelli, and Adam Benzik, and my newest LinkedIn connections, Joel Amaral, James Darren Shackelford, and Jason Hyde. Thank you so much for connecting and getting involved in this powerful education resource. For every one of my social links, find them, remarkableresults.biz/social. And many thanks for tuning into the Town Hall Academy, the single subject forum, broadcast live at 12 noon Eastern every Friday. Find the repurposed episode in the Academy toolbox on my website or on your podcast listening subscription. Now, go inside the Vision 2018 studio with the Educators Think Tank. With me is Rick Escalombre, retired instructor, Skyline College, and Educator of the Year 2017. Scott Brown from Diagnostic Network. Matthew Shanahan, Assistant Professor, Automotive Technology, College of DuPage, and Tim Dwyer from Console Labs. See the show notes page at remarkableresults.biz/E314 for extended bios and previous episodes that my guests have been on. This is a great slice of what is automotive education today, a very open and transparent discussion that will help you understand the education process and gain knowledge of how to get involved. There are some disturbing facts about enrollment versus the graduation rates, and also how many are employed within 2 to 3 years post-graduation. Here's an insider's look into automotive education. Learn about the challenges that post-secondary automotive technology programs have and how you can and must get involved. Now, please just don't think about getting involved. Just do it. Carm Capriotto here in the Vision 28 studio with the Vision Educators Think Tank. Never done this before. Glad to have you guys here. Rick Escalombre, instructor, retired. Say hi, Rick.
Hello to everyone.
Scott Brown, formerly IATN and things to come.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And Matthew Shanahan, Assistant Professor, Automotive Technology at College of DuPage.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, Matthew. And Tim Dwyer, Console Labs.
Hello. Hey, thank you for asking me to be here.
Okay. Rick Escalombre, Scott Brown, Tim Dwyer, all of podcasts. So when the show notes of this episode go out, you'll just need to click the listen here, and you'll be able to hear all the other episodes that they've participated in. So guys, there's this big thing here at Vision called the Educators Think Tank. It's an all-day program where you are out teaching instructors at the college level. Are there any high schools?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, high school and college to come in to learn from our industry's trainers so that they stay current. And then you also had a big keynote speech, Rick, and I know you presented it yesterday, and it was called What It Means to Be an Educator. Wow, what a powerful. So when you're done with this whole thing, did you hit it home?
I would say we did pretty close to that. It was emotional. It was based on 47 years of being in the industry, personal notes. Also was designed to inspire other instructors to be the best they could be based on what is not taught in grad school. These were the people skills, the management skills that they don't teach you when you're going through school.
We call them soft skills.
Oh, yeah.
And boy, when you talk to a service professional tech owner and you say, so how's your soft skills? And it's almost like you said a bad word to them, and they hover in the corner and they don't want to know about it. But today, how critical is that?
Oh, absolutely. You've got to be sensitive to people. And I think that's one of the things that's important. You've got to deal with administration who many times doesn't know what you're doing. So you've got to be laying the groundwork for them so they understand what's going on with your program. And, you know, the idea was to give instructors leadership because there's so many out there that feel they're in their own world and there's nobody else out there having the same issues. But a lot of things we heard yesterday from the questions Tim asked is many of them are dealing with the same concerns that everybody else has.
Like what, Tim?
Well, I think it was interesting that Rick's talk was on respect. And one of the first questions that I kind of homed in on was, how do you gain respect as a teacher? And the first two that I talked to said, you don't gain it, you earn it. And I said, well, you're right. That does make sense. And so it's a matter of giving respect to their students to get it. You know, I think that's a tough balance. I mean, all of us instructors have come from industry, and there's been a customer, you know, relationship kind of a skill. And now we're talking to young people, trying to attract them into this industry. We're trying to attract them into the technical side, but then also there's a lot more to teaching than just the technical side. Like you said, the soft skills. If we're not doing a good job on that, then we have these little prima donna techs that are kind of wagging the dog at shop, wagging the tail at shops and causing, I don't know, causing problems.
What are the challenges today, Matthew, being an instructor?
It's a balance of keeping up with technology, but also how to teach. So, one of the things that we kind of, when we select classes for the think tank, is we want to have a balance of technical classes to update instructors, but also more classes that are more pedagogical that kind of are how to teach. And because what happens is a lot of times, like, you know, if you're going to be an English teacher or a math teacher, a lot of your education may involve not just math or English, but how to teach those skills. For us, it's difficult because a lot of times instructor qualifications really, it comes down to we want real-world experience. And so the learning how to teach kind of comes on the back end. And so some of it is just from on-the-job experiences and then, you know, going to seminars like this and kind of learning those teaching skills.
Scott, when you're out in the field, and I know you're a pinnacle of our industry, you're in touch with everybody. Many of the techs, you know, back in the IATN days and you'd be monitoring the threads, did some techs want to become instructors?
You know, as I look back, I can see a lot of guys that in the early days, they didn't know they were going to become instructors, but they basically, organically grew into that. You could see in their writing and their communication skills on how they evolved and how they soon began to realize how to effectively communicate, you know. It's an important feature on communication. I would like to go back, though, to the to Rick's delivery. I learned some stuff about Rick that was very, very impactful. It was awesome. But going back to the questions about respect, the one key word that I honed in on from almost every one of those people, they said the word care. Now the care word is kind of a, you know, doesn't have that much emphasis on it, but it's huge. And I heard that reflecting from all these people are going, these kids just want to know that somebody's caring for them and caring about what they're doing in the industry. And that's kind of what I do. I care about what's going on in the industry. So it's awesome.
What kind of students are being graduated today? I mean, you come into a two-year program. You got, I don't know, 100 kids in the class. I don't know what the numbers are. Every school is different. How many come out at the end?
Our school, typically, we're seeing right now about 40% of maybe students that start that finish. There's some different reasons behind that. The industry itself doesn't really put too much value on certificates and degrees, and maybe it should, but what ends up happening is we have students that may take 4 to 8 classes and be halfway through a certificate or degree. They'll get a job, and then they kind of, the employer doesn't really require the certificate or degree, and they're making money, so they're not going to look back. And then a lot of times they, you know, scramble towards, you know, later on in life to try to get that certificate or degree. So that's one reason. Another reason is some students may start and realize it's not for them. They may have a passion for cars and realize that the repair industry is much different than maybe what they saw on TV on a Saturday morning show or something like that. So they realize that there's a lot more computer work involved or a lot more mechanical work than they wanted to do. And So, but some programs are going to vary. I know there's some programs that may be 90% or more. It just depends on the program and the type of students and how they're recruited.
Yeah, what Matt just mentioned, you know, the student comes in and he's looking at what the industry is. And that's one of the things that at NASTEF on this Road to Great Technicians, we're trying to fully illustrate or articulate what this career path could be. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a repairman or a technician or what have you. There are so many branches that you can spin off into. I mean, you could become a field service engineer. You could become a technical writer, an instructor. I mean, we're hitting into an age where these vehicles are so highly stacked with tech that they're going to roll through our independent sector, and they're going to be raising the bar pretty high on these guys. And the education that needs to come forth is, the demand is very, very high. So
what's it going to take day one, minute one, to get that student to graduate? That 60% that we're losing. Any ideas? I mean, I know there's no great answers here. Any ideas?
I say this respectfully. I call them today wannabes because they didn't grow up around vehicles, single-family homes, newer cars, maybe live in an apartment, whatever it might have been. So they didn't grow up in a service station like some of us did or playing with cars. So I call them respectfully wannabes. They're searching out the automotive industry. Is this something I want to do? As Matt said, they get in, they find out it's not for them. I was just running some numbers last night because we're into some issues at our college, and I was looking at the numbers, and we have a 90% retention rate of the students that come into our program, in our full-time program. And I attribute that a lot to, one, what we have at our facility, but two, the instructors we have and addressing the word care and really caring about the individuals first and making them feel important. Do all of them go into the automotive right away? No, some may never get there. But then you'll see some of them 4 or 5 years down the road, and where did they wind up? They wound up in the automotive industry. But what I really like about the NASTEF thing and the meeting we had the other day, the 4 hours, is it's the first time I've seen the careers on paper where they really put some thought into laying out what are the options if you choose to come into this industry. It isn't just service. It isn't just repair. There's so many other things that they could go into. We've never had that before. And you've heard me use the word disjointed before. This is part of putting the bones back together and saying, here's a viable career with many options. We've never done that in the past.
Yeah, I think that's your answer right there, is to basically illustrate, you know, that you're not going to be the guy turning wrenches, or you don't necessarily have to be that guy turning wrenches. You can move on.
So I have the, I guess, privilege of meeting a lot of instructors in my travels, and I talk to them quite a bit about just this retention rate. How do you know how many of them are staying in the industry after they graduate? And let's take the ones that actually do graduate. I'm afraid to say, I hear a lot of them aren't actually staying in the automotive industry because their skills are appreciated by a lot of different companies. And so I look at why can't the automotive shops hang on to these guys, and I worry about the working conditions, I worry about pay, I worry about, you know, image and things like that we're still kind of struggling with. And having other companies come in, you know, that don't have anything to do with auto mechanics, but to do with mechanics, taking these guys and putting them into positions, paying them better, and kind of like, I don't know, it's like we're training for bigger than automotive when we really need to be focusing on training for automotive. So,
yeah, the thing that, you know, I'm a shop owner, and I see the pain that the industry is in, and frankly, you know, I mentioned the tech earlier, you know, that the high level tasks that he's got to diagnose and understand these systems. That's really what enables the shop to do the rest of the work. Most shops are not modeled in a way that support that diagnostician the way he should be supported and the way that he would want to aspire to become that higher level guy. Even go back to the OE. The OE right now disencourages those guys to go that way because they get all these certs, they become qualified to do all the high tech stuff, and that's all they get, and it's doing warranty work, and they're getting paid peanuts. In the meantime, the water pump guy or the ball joint guy or the front end guy is coming in the morning and banging out a bunch of work and going home at the end of the day, not having to think about much else. And, you know, I hate to sound, you know, disparaging to that, but it's the fact.
I think a lot of what we were trying to do yesterday, too, was present those options to our instructors, too. I mean, they need to be aware of what it looks like. We talked about that yesterday. What does it look like in 5 years? What's the classroom going to look like to model the product that is going to go to the shop of the future? And when I say future, I don't mean 20 years. I mean 5 years and 3 years sometimes. So are we building our programs to equip the shop of tomorrow? I don't know. It's changing pretty quick, though. That's hard to say.
One thing I've seen as a positive change, but it's unfortunately not in the independent side of it, is we have a lot of employers now coming to us saying, hey, how can we attract your students? Because our students really have their choice of jobs when they are done. And by the way, that 40%, we debate this all the time at the college level. What is student success? So in my opinion, if a student takes four classes and doubles their income as employed, I would still consider that successful. So I'm not saying that 40% of my students are the ones that are going to be working in shops. It could be more than that. But these dealerships now are coming to us, large dealer groups or like regional, Ford, their regional dealers might come to us, and they literally come to us, hey, what can it take to employ your students? And so they allow us to actually train them. Hey, this is what our students are looking for, and here are some things to retain them. And my fear is that I'm not seeing too much of that on the independent side. And so some of the things that we kind of advise them is, hey, you got to work around the student's schedule. It's just a couple of years, and they'll be done. A lot of times employers are kind of narrow-sighted. Oh, we need you here 5 days a week, 40 hours a week. We can't work around your school schedule. So students will at least quit working there. Pay, I used to be the first person to say pay was a huge issue. And it is a small issue to my students, but really they're actually more worried about what they get to do on the job and how they're appreciated for it. So one of the things that we're going to and telling these dealers is, hey, you can't have this student changing oil 5 days a week. We kind of talked about this in the past, putting, paying your dues, sweeping the floor and doing oil changes. Maybe one day a week, you let them team up with one of the journeyman techs in the shop and kind of get some repair skills. I'm not saying that they need to be, working 38 hours a week on high-tech stuff, but let them get exposed to it a little bit instead of just getting burned out on oil changes and tire rotations for 4 years. So,
yeah, I agree. That's a broken mold right there. I mean, I envision a young guy that's enthusiastic, a student, goes into the shop and gets paired up with a guy that's, he's all over the car, right? Because that's the real experience, right? You're not just working on one section of the vehicle. You're figuring out why that power window's not working. Show him the analytical thought process. That's really where the power is. And I mentioned it yesterday, when we were having our Q&A session. These kids, we've always tapped the kids that, they need to go to shop because they don't seem to have the right aptitude. Well, that's not the right recipe. These kids need to learn. They need to understand, like, coding. I mean, you look at how program flows, and then that gives you the thought process of, hey, this isn't working. This is why this might be happening. So that's the part that's missing, and we need those kids to come into the shop and see some of those challenges out of the gate.
Yeah, right? And the industry doesn't maybe leverage them as well as they should, because some of these students have really good computer skills and analytical skills, and then they get stuck on those oil changes. So it could be a two-way street, because they still need to learn a lot of the mechanical skills that we all learn, how to take a bolt off without snapping it, stuff like that. That's going to come over time. But it could be a two-way street. I have students that graduate, and they're working in a dealer. Oh, yeah, it was great. I'm learning from this journeyman, but I actually got to teach him something. We had that on-car brake lathe in the corner gathering dust, and I learned how to use it in your class, and I was able to show him how to use it. So it can be a two-way street, because they do get exposed to some of the more advanced technology, and they've grown up with computers, and so they just need to learn some of the mechanical skills, but they may be able to trade some of those skills with those journeymen too. So it's not really a waste to have that journeyman training the apprentice, because that journeyman could learn something along the way, too.
Yeah, I took the approach with employers that when they asked me for a graduate, or we had an advisory board meeting and career day, I would tell them, you better grab them early on while they're in their training at Skyline, because if you don't, by the time you think you're going to get them as a graduate, they're already employed by a company that's worked with them, has kept them there. Loyalty is – there's more loyalty than we realize if the employer handles it correctly with the individual.
That's so true. I'm on an advisory board in Erie Community College. I joined last August, put my money where my mouth was, get involved in education, and the dealerships are taking them in that first year, and they're bringing them into a mentoring program.
They're recruiting very heavily, and they have entire human resources divisions designed to really recruit students. And it's not so much the for-profit schools and dealer programs that they're looking at. They've now, you know, they're still having such a shortage, and now they're going to the community colleges and high schools and trying to pick up the students before the independents have a chance. So,
I mean, let's face it, everyone needs techs. I mean, we're seeing it on the heavy-duty side of the industry too. I mean, it's neat. It's just a matter of, we need to step up and provide the right product. I think I said yesterday too, after spending a week at SEMA, you know, all the classes that I took on connected cars and you know, autonomous and et cetera, they basically said we need to embrace the fact that we're in the software business now. I mean, that's a lot of what we're going to be doing, and that's what Scott was saying over there, is, you know, the students need to be software savvy. I mean, because it's a big part of keeping are going from point A to point B.
So is the word they're going to become software analysts or what?
Not necessarily, but I think that, you know, a programmer, Steve Jobs had a saying or a recommendation years and years ago. He said he thought that everybody should learn how to do code, take time to learn at least a little bit of programming language, because that will help them become a better analyst or analytical thinker. You know, and I've took some programming stuff in the past, and it's like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense that, because these cars are basically, what are they doing? They're running code. And, you know, when a manufacturer builds a car, you know, they build, the failure modes engineer builds out a test plan for every conceivable failure. But what happens a decade later when that car has an issue that falls outside of that, the normal test plan? Technician's got to figure this stuff out. I mean, there's weird things that can happen, and you know, he's got to be savvy and being able to solve that. So that's they need that extra, you know, outside the box. I think what we're talking about here is that we're working within a mold that's got a lot of legacy or debt to it, you know, and we need to break the mold, right?
I think it's interesting you say outside the box, because I remember I used to say, because I had him in the last year, I had him for 9 months and in two classes as they finished the 3-year program. And I would say to them, do you want to be the 20% outside the box controlling the 80% inside, or do you want to be the 80% inside being controlled by the 20 outside? Put your thinking cap on. And many of them made it to that 20%. I'm very proud of that, because we need more of that.
It's more like 12%.
Yeah, I was being generous.
You've always counted on Moog to keep you ahead of the pack when it comes to chassis innovation. Well, they've done it again. Most recently launched is the Moog ball joint with a pre-installed integral dust boot. It's designed exclusively for compression-loaded suspension systems, providing superior strength and durability for these types of vehicle applications. The dust boot is made from higher-strength materials and comes pre-installed, saving you time because it's easier to install. It also has a larger contact area against the stud, which makes a more effective seal. For your customers, the unit uses Moog's powdered metal gusher bearing that provides longer life and controlled radial and axial movement. You get the industry's leading coverage of 10,000 SKUs, including 4,600 for foreign applications. Hey, you've been installing Moog confidently for years, and now you know why. Know why you install Felpro, the gaskets professionals trust? Every part that goes into a Felpro box is validated and approved by a Felpro engineer. Product testing and validation is an integral part of Felpro's engineering, manufacturing, and field testing, where vehicles undergo tests that log over 1 million miles every year. They also reach out to you, the pro, through technology blogs and their technical forums to listen, learn, and keep in touch with you. It's amazing to think that Felpro produces over 325,000 gaskets per day. That's 325,000 per day in their 1 million square foot facility in Skokie, Illinois. Under the same roof, engineering and manufacturing uphold Felpro quality, utilizing 4,500 active production tools with tooling tolerances to 5 microns. Now that's smaller than a human hair. A tight tolerance like that ensures the sealing ability of Felpro gaskets. And their own in-house chem lab develops proprietary formulations like PermaDry Plus to produce 35,000 molded rubber sealing components every day. Plus, with Felpro, you get coverage from 1955 of 96% of all domestics and 93% of all import vehicles. So feel confident that with new engines and new technologies, Felpro will be there with innovative solutions to solve your customers' sealing problems. Felpro, the gaskets professionals trust. Go to felpro-only.com for more information.
Matthew, what's the biggest struggle for you today as an instructor?
I don't know if my struggles would be the same as maybe the nationwide, because I'm in a very wealthy district, so we are probably, you know, funded and ran the way a community college should be. So I like to think, you know, as I visit other community colleges around me, maybe some of the issues that they face. And so it may be, in some respects, equipment purchasing.
So equipment's good. Recruiting is good. Facility is good.
For mine, yeah. Yeah, I'm lucky enough where I teach in a 30,000-square-foot facility. So we have, you know, over 30 bays. We have four classrooms with dedicated bays inside the classrooms. And one of the great things that we've done, one of the things that we really wanted to do is continue to make group sizes smaller. And so, you know, like when I teach a class, like a drivability class, I have enough scan tools where, you know, group sizes are two or three people rather than, you know, four or five.
What's your equipment spend every year?
We could easily spend, and you already know, Tim, because we spend a lot with you all the time. Just I think capital and budget can be, you know, well over $150,000 a year. And then Perkins funding could, you know, bump that over $200,000.
There's going to be people listening to this.
Not the norm.
That are going to say, OMG.
Yeah.
How can I get to that school?
And so one of the things that we actually had to do now is, like, for instance, you know, car donations, those have kind of, you know, at least from the manufacturer side, they've kind of gone away. And so we're trying to make sure we have advanced systems in our fleet. And so we have a fleet of about 60 cars right now, and we are purchasing about five cars or more per year right now. So we go and buy a 1 or 2 year old used car. And so, you know, currently we're spending, you know, around $80,000 a year just on buying cars to make sure we have a fleet.
It sounds like you guys are state of the art. You're really thinking large about what it takes to train our student. How many are going through? Did I ask you that earlier? I don't remember. How many are going through the program?
We're at about I think around usually between 100 and 120 full-time equivalents. So we might have over 200 unique students.
Guys, that's a hell of an investment per student, isn't it, per year?
Yeah. That's something I wanted to address, because I'm seeing the handwriting on the wall, especially in California. We're in a very tax-rich district because of property taxes. But what I'm seeing down the road is when we hit the next financial downturn, I think CT programs and industry are going to have to be strong. Because I just got an email last night stating how there's this grant, there's meetings, all on student success. The student success isn't about the automotive student we're turning out. The student success plan is about the person who is coming to community college unprepared. And the amount of money they have to spend to teach basic skills to get them up to speed. So as I used to refer to it, as community college was starting to become a glorified high school, because this wasn't being done in high schools anymore. When dollar gets short, CTE programs are going to have to fight. And it's not the norm. His wasn't the norm. Ours wasn't the norm. But the other schools, and we have 77 in California, many of them are going to struggle, because that downturn, they're going to look to what's the most expensive program. And I got news for you. It's ours. Per student, it is ours.
I'm already starting to see it, even at our school with, you know, very, very wealthy tax base. Programs, they're starting to look at them from a cost per student perspective. And I think it's important to think back to the, you know, really the reason you have a community college is serving the community. So it's not necessarily looking at individual programs. It's really, you should be looking at what are the needs in the community. And I think that, we need to stress as educators and that there is no doubt that there is a high demand right now for trained technicians. So it's important that we continue to use that as our reasoning. Hey, we're trying to serve the community, because at the end of the day, the whole thing behind community colleges is that, you know, first of all, you're going to take a student and you're going to, you know, increase their income. So now your tax base, you know, you're going to kind of repay back eventually, hopefully, what you've invested. But also, you know, as a member of the community, maybe you're an attorney or a doctor or whatever else, your car breaks down. Now there's someone there in the community to fix the car. You know, you fall over and you hurt your arm. Now there's someone at the hospital to x-ray it. So the community college goal is really to just make sure that the needs of the community are fulfilled, and we're going to make sure that jobs in the community are filled. So that's really, I think, one of the things moving forward that we need to articulate.
My message to industry is they need to step up, as you did with the school in your area, because they're going to need that support from the local business communities. That's one thing Board of Trustees will listen to. And if they're there and they're strong and they're backing the program will be in much better shape than if they're leaving alone, because they will die on the vine. The next financial downturn, CTE is going to be in a crisis.
So if you want to do something to pay it forward in the industry, join an advisory council. When I got on, there were only two independents out of like a dozen.
But you can be there. You don't necessarily have to be. You can be involved with your school somehow, some way. Even if you don't go on the advisory board, there's so many other ways you can
talk to them.
Yeah, there's a good example. Exactly. You know, looking back after all these and seeing the changes and seeing the trends changes, technology is one thing. But the industry, especially the independent industry after the last downturn, as I mentioned to you yesterday, it's survival mode. And they aren't thinking out of the box. They're thinking, what am I going to get through next month, next month, next month, where they used to go out and get somebody and they build for the future. Now it's, I got to get through next month, and if I can do it with one less person, maybe I'll survive. That's what I see out our way. One thing I want to say with Matt is I want to make sure you're clear is our districts may be affluent, but the students that come to us aren't. That's something that's real important.
That's one thing Rick and I were talking about just yesterday, actually, is, you know, a lot of times we may have the students that really are some of the poorest in the district sometimes. So sometimes there's assumption, oh, it's a rich district. I mean, but they struggle buying textbooks and the technology necessary or tools necessary to really get employed.
Is yours a certificate program or a degree program?
We have both a certificate and a degree program. The only difference in terms of the certificate and degree are just general education classes.
So. And are they having problems with them?
Some students do, but we really urge the students, and actually a lot of the dealership employers actually prefer the degree over the certificate because they want students with math skills, English, speech. So those are some of the differences between the degree versus certificate. So the employers are really the ones that do have a preference for a certificate or degree. They really want the degree.
It's the student's choice based on money?
Just whether or not it's not so much. Well, it is going to cost them more, but really, it's really whether or not they want to take those additional classes. We urge them all the time to try to do the degree rather than the certificate.
Yeah, we support that too. But I got to say this, and the bottom line here is the best recommendation for any student to an employer is that instructor. I've had students go to job interviews, and I come back the next day. So how'd it go? Well, geez, I don't know. Only asked me a couple questions. Told me had the job already. Why? Because of reputation. And the instructor that recommended them. They had a working rapport with the college where they knew the people. They were involved with us. And if we recommend them, it was our reputation. Were we wrong once in a while? Yeah. But what they found was if we recommended them, that's what they went by most. They didn't ask for an ATEF task list. They didn't ask for a degree. They asked, are they a good employee that I can work with? And you think they'll hang around in the future? Well, the best we can tell you is they will. And the degree is nice, but I've never had an employer hire a person for a degree. If they couldn't fix cars or service cars, they weren't going to make it.
We always tell students that the degree is kind of a foot in the door, but you still have to sell yourself. And I'm also in a unique role because I also teach part-time for Southern Illinois University, and we have a bachelor's degree in automotive technology. And you're going to start to see more and more students not enter the repair side of this industry because they're going to continue to do these bachelor's degrees. So if you think that we have a shortage, the automotive industry on the more, you know, field service engineers or people working at the corporate level, they're having an even more shortage. So currently, the SIU students who graduate, they could be 22 years old with their bachelor's. Right now, the last stat was 89% of them are employed before they even graduate. And the average starting salary is almost $60,000. It's like $59,800 was the starting salary. So 22-year-old kids, so the good students, that's where we urge them to go.
So let me understand, Matthew. I'm going to 2 years or 3 years for automotive tech, however that blends out, and then I'm picking a major, a business major, or a marketing major. How does that work?
Well, so we have an agreement. We have like what we call like a 2+2 agreement. So you can go and take, you can get my associate in an applied science degree at College of DuPage, and then you can transfer. You're guaranteed to transfer as a junior to the SIU program. And so 2 more years down at SIU, and you can get that bachelor's degree.
How about articulation agreements with the high school level cooperative educational programs where they, you know, 10 schools go to one place for shop? Are they being able to transfer credits over into college?
We have one. Students can come to our program with 3 classes already completed from high school.
Ours is one because also the number of schools that you articulate with now have dropped significantly. And that's one of the dilemmas we face for the long run. This is why we see kids not make it in their first year because they were exploring. They had no background and exposure to this. But, yeah, we articulate 1 class. They get our fundamentals course because we are still a special application program. You cannot get into our program unless you meet the minimum requirements through a special application. One of them is automotive training, basic English, basic math, basic reading. and you can meet the automotive requirements a number of ways. If they do high school automotive, the schools we articulate with, if this instructor signs off on them, then they bypass our fundamentals course. They're guaranteed placement in the program, providing they meet those other requirements, the general ed requirements.
Where is the struggle at your level of college? Are they passing lecture more, or passing lab more, or failing more?
Ours is integrated. So ours is okay. Ours are 365-hour, 15-unit courses. So
you don't separate lab or
no.
Okay.
So they're working on that. They're trying to do that now. I was on some emails last night trying to help to offset this, but the continuity of one large class is so much better. It's better for the student. It's better for the instructor because you can get into things. You're not cutting it like the bell ringing 2 hours from now. You're not in the middle of a lab assignment 2 hours. Well, that class is over. Got to go to this. We balance it up. We might have 20 hours of lab in 1 week and maybe only 10 the next week. It'll vary. It'll depend on the class, depend on the students. It's a balance.
How much time are you spending, Matthew, actually teaching?
So my actual, face-to-face time with students is, anywhere from like 16 to 18 hours. I've done more in a semester, but I try to keep it lower because otherwise it becomes too much. And
what becomes too much? The administration work that you have to do?
So, I mean, to be able to teach 16 hours, you're probably going to have at least, to teach 1 hour, you're probably going to have at least, an hour or two of prep and grading and stuff like that. So, I mean, teaching 15 hours a week could turn into a 45-hour-a-week job. And on top of that, I'm expected to participate in committees and my contract also, advising students. And so it can be quite a bit.
But those are all good things. I mean, I think the advisorship is good. In the good old days, Rick, how much time did you spend instructing?
80 to 90%. I can remember telling a chancellor in 1993, Joe, I said, Joe, teachers are only teaching 70% of the time now. And that was in 93. When I left, I'm going to give you still do your job. You still teach. But what's been piled on top of it, the ability to research, prepare, you're doing this in hours that you just shouldn't be doing them in because you've got committee after committee after committee, accountability, which is just going nowhere. As many instructors I'll hear this know about student learning outcomes, they're going in a database that nothing's being done with. There are endless hours of time into that. But the actual quality teaching time, I'm going to tell you now, when I left, I felt it was like 40%. And I see teachers on campus. I see teachers on campus. They're burned out in November now, and they're burned out in April because there's just committee after committee and subcommittee of the subcommittee and then subcommittee of the subcommittee and just endless stuff that takes you away from what you were hired to do and what you do best.
Well, I was just going to say, I think equally important is the amount of time that we spend with the student. I don't think that the technology has changed. We still have so many hours a day with them, and I think industry is expecting us to turn a product out faster than we can. I mean, you cannot make it happen any faster. There's just more. There's more to learn, and granted, we're in a technician shortage, or every shop I talk to could stand to have a technician. It can't happen any faster.
Right. If we go back to what you were talking about, Carm, where the outreach, you only had a small percentage of the independent sector. I own an independent shop, but I can't remember the last time a college came to me asking me to be part of a focus or, focus group or advisory board or what have you. And so I think that's where we have a disconnect. They don't have a good perspective on really the needs of that industry.
Something Tim said, and it was one of the last things I mentioned yesterday, was, teach less, learn more. But one of the other things that is so difficult for kids today is they're being asked to know in 2 and 3 years from our program, coming out of our programs, what has taken many of us 20, 30, 40, or more years to learn. That's asking quite a bit of these individuals, especially when they grew up with little or no automotive background. So employers have to be patient. I've had employers frustrated because they couldn't do four different things at once when they were on the job.
Guys, let's talk about future instructors. I mentioned it earlier, but I remember sitting down with a few of them that said, if you have a certificate program, do you need a teacher with a teaching degree or a teaching certificate? And I guess someone that I know left the industry, invested, $10,000 or something to go back to school to get their you know, I says, you making enough money? No, I'm just passionate to do this. And I said, and you justified the investment to leave to become an instructor. And he says, yeah, it's in my heart to do this. Is that going to be a barrier to entry for new instructors?
The problem with a lot of schools is their pay systems are kind of outdated as well. And so education gets rewarded, but sometimes experience doesn't. And so our school, this is a fight that we keep having, as we used to have, you know, equivalency. That's another thing Rick and I were talking about yesterday. So, you know, a lot of times they would say, okay, X amount of years and ASC certification would be like a master's degree equivalent, and then it would allow you to move over as you get higher education. But realistically, at a college level, you're going to have to, at a minimum, get a bachelor's degree because of typically regional accreditation issues. And then, you know, we can get someone hired in at an associate's degree level, but they're going to have to get a bachelor's degree. Eventually, it's probably best to get a master's degree. And right now, I'm working on my doctorate degree, so I know how it goes. I got a lot of education behind me, and I never thought I would get this.
Your aspirations are what? Superintendent? Dean? Something like that?
Not really. I thought maybe I wanted to be a dean one day, but no, I don't want to go to the dark side. I think I'm going to stay. No, I'm just trying to get I just really kind of got addicted to education, and so I like taking the classes to become a better person, and I really like enjoy it. So,
but this is a stumbling block, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. We for part-time courses, I could hire anyone I wanted to.
Adjunct,
if I felt that for adjunct, I could hire anyone I wanted. When I left, you now cannot apply for a full-time. Well, we're still, I think, pretty fair, but I could even put someone in on equivalency just on base experience. Maybe if they taught for us part-time for a while, now they have to have the minimum GE requirements for an AS degree. They can put their work experience on top of that and get into the full-time position. A lot of times the BA, the MA is for one entity, and that's the administration. They want to show that they have all that. I'm sorry, but I had nowhere in our area to go to get do anything master's-wise in automotive. Didn't need to. I didn't see the point.
I didn't even have a college degree when I started teaching.
Yeah, you got to go out and listen to Tim Dwyer's episode. It is really a phenomenal episode. It really taught me an awful lot. I mean, his passion from a shop owner and then instructor and then learning how to do team-based education, which was, and then into console labs. Wow. I mean, and there's a pathway, right?
Yeah. And when I was listening to Matt's description of his environment at his school, I was thinking, man, if I was out of a job and looking for something to do, might be a good place to go look. But can I work remote from California?
No,
because I don't think your weather is kind of.
And it's not the norm. I tell you, I visit a lot of schools, and you're pretty blessed to have that stuff.
Well, that's why I brought it up when he asked me what are the struggles. I think that my struggles are much different than 90% of the programs out there. That's why I wanted to just fully disclose that.
Yeah, there's schools that are probably operating on less than the taxes you paid on your equipment, and that's terrible. I mean,
yeah, and that's going to be an issue. I mean, you mentioned cars earlier. I think Skyline, they just got 3 more Nissans. I think we're at 100 vehicles. But that's not the norm. And what's going to happen down the road is where are the resources going to come from to address this new technology? Will it be on a console lab trainer? Will it be through web-based stuff? Because the physical vehicle probably is not going to be anywhere near the shop.
Yeah, I think that really we're going to have to augment this. And I think the data connection to the vehicle and then into the space where it could be become an extension of the learning, you know, experience. Because every car you connect to, if you think about it, every car connect that gets a connection, you know, in the shop is usually one that's broken. And a lot of times those are learning experiences. So if there would be a way for someone to pull that data together and start to articulate and create stories and learning opportunities. Because learning is not always in the traditional sense where you would go into a classroom and sit and come to vision. These guys are remote. You know, they're out in the middle of nowhere. They can't travel and get this learning. So the beauty of the internet is that it brings us all together and closer. And I think that we can leverage that to bring that knowledge further to us.
Put your thinking cap, your vision cap on for me for a moment. Tell me what the future in this whole web-based thing is going to look like.
I envision a number of things. I think that we can leverage, you know, bring industry further together, bring some visibility to the educational institutions out there, the small, you know, companies that are delivering some really good product, but not everybody knows about that. and the depth of talent that these companies have behind them. I think they need to showcase that stuff a little more. So that coupled with you know, the high tech companies out there that are currently providing some level of support, you know, I think that that support demand is going to grow. But it shouldn't just be a support piece. It should be more of an educational piece along the way. And again, I think the infrastructure needs to be kind of reformatted so that we encourage these guys to gain more knowledge and experience, and they're rewarded for achieving that higher level of a skill set. Because again, these guys are going to be the ones that enable that shop to continue to provide the service, the regular services on that car. If they can't fix these failures, the cars aren't going to show up.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the cool part about vision too, is that we talk about a little bit of a disconnect, but they're all in this building together this weekend. We have teachers and shop owners and technicians and everything. And if there's common problems, it gets discussed, maybe on the trade show floor, maybe in the lobby down there, maybe in the classroom. And so little by little, you know, the people that are not necessarily industry leaders, but they kind of are. I mean, people that show up to Vision in particular, I think, are above and beyond. I mean, they're striving to make things better, whether it's their business, their classroom, or as a technician. When they start talking, good things happen.
Yeah, that's a great thing about coming to this event. I mean, this is what I look forward to, because you're networking with your colleagues and the same people that have the same vision and passion and come together.
This place is Prego, I think, isn't it? It's in there, right? Remember that commercial? Yeah. It's in there. I mean, this is a you know, a microcosm of every segment of the industry with one simple focus: to come here to learn.
I think back to our first educator think tank, and we had about 125 people in the room. And when we finished that day, I remember saying to Kevin Levy, "Kevin, we need a bigger room and we need industry in here." I remember standing right there on the stage and looking him in the face, and he said, "I'll see what I can do." The next 3 years, and a big thank you to Scott and how he stepped up with producing it and broadcasting it, we grew to 300-plus people. One other thing we're missing today that is our driving force and our vision is George Minshew. Without him, none of us would be sitting here right now. He's the one that had the vision back in 2011 to tell Sherry, you need to get involved with the educators. And so much of what we're doing today, and even up to the point of the reception or the luncheon yesterday, he was on the phone with us. Scott had him on the phone, wanting to assure that we had everything in order, feeling, you know, very bad that he couldn't be here, but we should take care of it.
Checking down the list, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He gave us some marching orders. He gave specifically some top level orders for Rick to follow. Yep. And then he's telling us, okay, guys, I want you to look in the eyes of these guys and make sure that they understand, you know, where they're at, and you need to read them.
I'm really sad that George couldn't be here. Obviously, he had a last minute change, but anyone who, you know, George did two episodes with me, and they are like primo good. You just owe it to yourself to.
He embodies the word vision.
Oh,
and
he does.
He can see the bigger picture better than anybody I've ever known. I like to tell a little story about George. It was 1991 at an ASC conference in Anaheim, California. I went for the first time, and there was this young man there doing a presentation on big box lab scopes, electronic lab scopes with analogs, the CRTs, and it was George Minshew. And I sat in there for a few hours. I watched him sweat, and I still tease him about it this day. That was the start of it all for George. And I see where he's come today. It's amazing.
Let's tell stories out of school. If you listen to Scott Brown's episode, he, of course, drops George Minshew's name, right? You remember that?
Yeah, we were just actually talking about that. That same event, that ASC trade show, that there's a guy named Mark Warren in there that he was sitting at the front of the class, and I was sitting at the back, and he started asking some questions, and I'm going, oh my God, that guy's mean. I don't want to mess with that guy. But I just ran into him in the hallway down here, and I told him about this story we were talking about. So, yeah, it's awesome. But yeah, George, basically, he was the one that told me, I was buying a program from him to hook to my lab scope so I could start dissecting stuff. And he goes, hey, do you have a modem in your machine? And I go, what's a modem?
I don't know what a modem is either. I don't know. I was five when you guys were at this conference. I was 5 years old. So.
Oh my gosh,
Fisher Price modem.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Great. It's a great story in your episode. Okay, every year you have an educator of the year. And I believe, was it last year you won?
No, I was the first one in 2015. Oh, you were the, okay. Thanks to these guys that I knew absolutely nothing about.
You missed the meeting.
We made them cry.
I thought we weren't addressing it. They brought it up. I thought we hadn't addressed it, and I'm sitting in the meeting, and Sherry says, now we have to do an Educator of the Year Award. And I'm thinking, I was on a committee. Who the heck we pick? And she selected me, and I got to tell you, I was flat-out honored. It was the greatest thing ever. And the people we've picked after that, and especially yesterday. Yesterday was even more special with Jim Morton. But Jeff Curtis, Bill Lieb, and then Jim Morton yesterday, literally being in the doctor's office, having his drain removed, watching it on Facebook Live, and the doctor's clapping while he's getting his award.
How cool is that?
And I want to.
Yeah, that was cool. We were talking about that last night, about the technology, okay? Just imagine where we were 20 years ago, and here we are today, and this guy is getting a reward. You know, he's had some episodes, and he's sitting in another space, and he's real time in our room. I mean, that was pretty awesome.
And you had to step up and give his class.
Yeah, I'll do that this afternoon. But
oh, it's today. Okay.
Yeah. He. One thing I thought of last night, and I copied the guys on this, is he and I were going back on Facebook IM, and I wanted to assure him, and I want him to hear this again, that this award was picked last fall, long before his medical conditions. And he says, thank you. He says, that means a lot to me because I started thinking that maybe I got it because of what I was going through. And I wanted him to know that we did it. It was unanimous, and it was long before he ever had the medical condition. He has a lot of other issues, but no, I'm only kidding. But no, he deserved it. He's probably, you could call him Mr. Vision in a different way. Nobody promotes this conference better than him.
Well, we've never had so many recommendations either for one instructor so far, and they came in from all over the place.
So. Hey, I so enjoyed this, the Educator Think Tank here at Vision 2018. Rick Escalambre, instructor retired, Scott Brown, formerly IATN, but I think we heard some things today about maybe where we're going. Matthew Shanahan, assistant professor, Automotive Technology, College of DuPage, and Tim Dwyer from Council Labs. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
I was lucky enough to get a few of the Education Think Tank leaders into the Vision Studio in March 2018. So grateful to Rick Escalambre, Scott Brown, Tim Dwyer, and Matthew Shanahan. See the show notes where the key talking points are outlined for you. Go to remarkableresults.biz/E314. And you have your marching orders. Please get involved at every level of education. The shortage of skilled technicians does start at the middle school level. We collectively, in the industry, need to get the message to parents, teachers, counselors, principals, and superintendents. They must see the industry's involvement in the future of automotive technology education programs. We must be evangelists for keeping and growing the automotive technology programs at all levels of education. It may take days to repair vehicles if there's no skilled technicians joining our ranks, so please do what you can. Many more interviews from educators on the podcast. See the homepage for the Educators series. Thanks for being here to show your support. Glad you enjoy. Share this so that all ships rise.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.